Welcome to the Novel Ideas Podcast.
The Novel Ideas Podcast, a podcast with two siblings who love books.
I threw all my books into the ocean, actually, because I realized that life was a lie.
Why'd you do that? Because life was a lie?
Yeah.
I don't understand.
Well, maybe if you read The Girl in the Road, you'll understand less.
I read The Girl in the Road, and now I don't understand things anymore.
I've lost my entire perspective on what life is and what happens in it.
I don't even.
So that's our review of The Girl in the Road.
Yes. Tune in next week when we read.
Yeah. So, hi. We're back. I'm Gabs.
I'm Ben.
We're actually in the same room this time, which is very exciting.
Yay!
It's a Novel Ideas celebration? Anniversary? I was gonna call it a Novel Ideas first, and then I was like, no.
Not true.
Recorded most of our episodes.
It's a throwback episode of Novel Ideas. In a minute, someone will be bringing some piece of landscaping equipment by the window.
And then a cat will come in the room and start meowing.
Yes.
That is what is going to happen. So this episode, we read The Girl in the Road by Monica Byrne, in case you couldn't tell from our earlier conversation. We chose this book largely because we are trying to more consciously read women authors and people of color, but not just more women, which I guess we always do, but specifically women writing science fiction, since they're a little bit more of a, I don't say know if rare is the right word, but just not read as much, maybe, is more accurate to say.
I actually don't know what the author statistics would be, or if anyone even keeps anything like that. My guess would be that in older science fiction, up until an arbitrary point of, I don't know, probably, maybe even still, but definitely 20 or 30 or 40 years ago, it was heavily represented by male authors writing male characters. And now that is less the case. There are a lot of very successful women writing science fiction, and who have a wider voice, and partly because society and partly because that community, I think, has also made a conscious effort to make sure that women have a voice in their community and aren't like the one woman in a sea of pasty, sweaty creepers when they go to convention.
Yeah, most people appreciate that. So that's why we chose this book. It was recommended to me by a friend as a good science fiction book written by a woman, so we decided to go ahead and give it a try, and we are planning more devious things for the future where we read more science fiction written by women and people of color, so stay tuned.
That's right. I guess as we've been saying, this is a science fiction novel, technically. It's also a little bit of like a travel story.
It is definitely, I think,
maybe more of a road story.
The author, like, even alludes to, like, the traditional travel narrative at times throughout the book. I think she was very conscious of it.
Mm-hmm.
But it is also science fiction, and unlike a lot of the science fiction we've read, which is in space, or she mentioned in an interview that she wanted to stay away from the very popular post-apocalyptic sort of thing. She more just took the world and kind of nudged it forward 30, 40 years, so it had some, like, cool new technology and social things going on, and then set it, instead of setting it in the U.S. or in Western Europe or the Western world at all, she plopped it down in the India-Africa part of the world so that we were getting a new perspective. Because they're kind of more of the up-and-coming or the dominant forces now instead of the old Western powers.
Yeah, I mean, just in terms of where the world's population is weighted, you would assume that the near future economy and what will be written as history would have more to do with India and China. And also, I think in one of those author interviews, what was at the back of the book, she, Monica Byrne, had mentioned that, you know, the most common group of people on this planet are brown women. So she wanted to write a book that featured brown women instead of, say, white men.
Yeah, because she mentioned that, you know, the travel narrative, traditionally the hero is a white guy, like, running around trying to reach whatever goal. And originally she almost wrote the, I think, Mina's character as a white woman, and then thought, wait a minute, that's not right.
Yeah.
Let's not do that. So, all right, so plot synopsis. I guess we should institute our spoiler policy really quick, actually, before we read our spoilery plot synopsis. This book came out the year before, very recently. So if you are interested in reading The Girl on the Road and don't want any spoilers, you should turn off the podcast right now, because our plot synopsis is very spoilery.
And here it comes. My plot synopsis is two murderers stagger towards each other incoherently.
It's accurate. But you don't actually find out they're murderers until, like, the very last part of the book.
Yes.
Mm. So, in hindsight, good plot synopsis, but... yeah, so who are our... I guess one of the things about this book that makes it kind of confusing is the structure's a little different, because we do have two narrators, as Ben likes to call it.
Cotagonists.
Classic cotagonist example. We have Mina and Mariama, who basically have an equal voice, and we're following Mina as she's crossing this bridge across the ocean trying to get to Ethiopia, and then we're following Mariama talking about her childhood, like joining basically like a caravan of trucks driving toward Africa. And we don't really know how or why their two stories are related until the end, where it all kind of ties in together, basically. But yeah, I guess we talk a little bit about these two characters and kind of why you threw the word incoherently into the plot synopsis. Why that kind of matches. So I guess we talk about Mina first.
Sure. I think she has the first chapter, right?
Yeah.
So Mina is an Indian woman. She's running from something,
mm-hmm.
but it's kind of a vague, faceless they at the beginning.
Yeah, it's hard to tell how much if she's actually being stalked or if it's just her paranoia.
Yeah.
She thinks this terrorist organization is after her, but we don't really know how legitimate that fear is.
Yes. So, you know, it's... It almost doesn't matter because it doesn't really come up anymore once she hits the road, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But she has, well, I mean, she is has some sort of mental illness, I think.
Yeah, she mentions that she has these manic episodes where she's more likely towards paranoia, and I thought that could possibly mean she's bipolar, but she never says that directly.
Yeah.
So that's kind of a guess, but...
And she's given a little bit to kind of... to some little moments of fantasy, and she's more willing to, like... She's kind of impulsive, I think,
mm-hmm.
is the word I was looking for. And so, yeah, we don't have, like, a diagnosis for her, but she doesn't have manic moments in the sense of, like... Oh, well, you know, sometimes I just have to, you know, go to the store and start buying things on an impulse. Look at me. It's more like, no, like, I think people are chasing me and I sleep with random strangers and
I'm going to decide to walk across a 2,000-kilometer-long bridge.
Right. I buy a bunch of survival supplies and go out onto the open ocean.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's one of the things I think that's kind of started right off the bat is Mina and Mariama are both kind of holding stuff back from you. And I think in Mina's case, and in Mariama's case, they don't necessarily always know they're holding stuff back from you because I think they're also confused.
True.
kind of one of the hallmarks of both of their narrations. So at times it can get confusing because they might not be telling the whole truth, or they might be lying, or you're kind of like a classic unreliable narrator thing going on.
Yeah.
And especially at the beginning, like, I will say that in those first couple chapters where I, like, didn't actually really know what was happening, I guess I can credit the writing for making the book, like, read as chaotic and confusing as Mina felt at the time when she was, like, trying to run away. So, our mom is making a ton of noise upstairs. Yeah, let's actually, I want to talk a little bit about her sleeping with random people, because this is kind of an interesting part of her character that is brought to the book that I thought was pretty unique as far as most characters you read about.
Yeah, she's a very sexual person, and is not, doesn't really have, like, a defined sexuality.
Yeah, at the very beginning she mentions that she has this girlfriend named Mohini, and so I thought, okay, you know, I could kind of get that. And then she mentioned that she sleeps with guys, like, that's the first, she meets this dude and they end up falling into bed together, and I thought, oh, okay. And so she never, like, you know, specifically says I'm one sexuality or another, but it was interesting because Ben and I were thinking that the way she reads as more than just, like, a straight bisexual. She seems like the sort of person who's kind of, if you've heard the term, like, pansexual.
Yes.
Someone who just, like,
omnisexual.
Yeah, like, just wants to sleep with people, and, like, the gender doesn't really have anything to do with it. And she definitely struck me as that sort of person who just, like, doesn't buy into sexual mores, like, whatsoever.
Yeah. Like, it's almost like self-medicating for her in some ways. Like, it temporarily calms her down, and the next morning she wakes up and she's like, ah, gotta get the fuck out of here.
Yeah.
Who is this person?
And she tries to, I think, blame it at the end of the book a little bit for, like, having grown up an orphan. Or, like, you know, her parents being killed when she was little. Maybe she's searching for connections by having sex with all these people, but I don't know how, again, like, how reliable that is on her part, because she is kind of losing touch with reality toward the end of the book.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I just think that's, like, really cool about her, that she has sex with all these people, and it's, like, totally non-judgmental from the author's point, and the author, I don't think, is ever really saying, like, this is a terrible bad habit that's, like, driving her to destruction. She's definitely doing other things to herself that are worse than sleeping with some strangers.
She has other bad habits that are driving her to destruction.
Yeah. So, I don't know. I think that's a fun take that you don't see very often in characters. They usually don't get to do that.
Yeah.
Anything else you want to say about Mina?
Nope.
Gosh, Ben.
No thoughts.
Being so helpful.
I know, I'm trying. No, I think that's good.
Okay. Mariama,
our co-tagonist, our other unreliable narrator.
Yep.
She's young for the first, I don't know, three quarters of her story, which is a big part of it. She's 10, I think, when we meet her, and she's also on the run initially.
And again, we don't really know why. We know she, like, her and her mom were slaves and ran away from the guy who owned them. And she goes to, like, find her mom in the little, like, I don't know, refugee camp or little house they're squatting in or whatever it is. And she sees something and she runs off. But we don't know until the end of the book what exactly that is.
Yeah. And so, you know, she gets taken in by, well, not really taken in. She kind of sneaks into a caravan. And then the two guys in charge just kind of decide that, eh, what the hell. I guess she's not hurting anything and no one's going to miss her, so come along. But she is, like, kind of this, I mean, not surprisingly, a childlike voice, even when she is an adult in the later part of her story, she retains a lot of those childlike mm-hmm. qualities. Has some of the, like, innocent interpretations of things that go along with that. But because she's been around, also been around some bad stuff, she will occasionally innocently say something that you wouldn't expect a child to say.
Yeah.
Sexual comments, those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's witnessed firsthand some of this, like, violence and sexual violence and that sort of thing. But she just doesn't really get it. So she just parrots, I think, either what she's heard or seen, and then doesn't really get why other people are...
not happy with her when she does that.
Yeah.
Yeah. She has... I don't know, she tends to fixate a little bit on, like, a person, like, almost a person as a concept, maybe.
Well, yeah, case in point, so, Yemaya, how do we want to definitively say her name?
Ugh, boy.
Yemaya, Yemaya.
So, of course we didn't look it up. Yemaya is how I said it in my head the whole time I was reading it. Yemaya, I have a suspicion, is closer to being right.
All right, well, let's call her Yemaya.
Okay.
So this is this older woman who joins the caravan along with Mariama, and she's actually telling her whole narrative, like she's telling it to Yemaya.
Yes.
And we know whoever this is, at first I thought, you know, oh, she's like talking to some goddess maybe of her religion or something. It's kind of how she was approaching it, but then we find out that she was a real person, and she was just kind of a godlike figure in this child's eyes, basically.
Yeah. Though named after a goddess.
Yeah, named herself after a goddess.
Yeah.
and one of the things that I thought was kind of interesting is that, like, whatever this relationship was that made Mariama so intently focused on Yemaya, she's, even as an adult, she's still talking to her and thinking about, like, what would she do or what would she advise me to do, and almost expecting her to, like, mystically come back into her life, and that's a really interesting... odd.
Yeah, and then
fixation.
And then when she meets Gabriel, he almost becomes like a not quite as good temporary surrogate figure
mm-hmm.
for Yemaya. And that doesn't end well for him. that's where the murder part comes in.
But doesn't Mariama, like, decide to sleep with him finally because she thinks, like, Yemaya sent her a sign or something?
Yes.
So even that is still steeped in her odd beliefs about Yemaya.
Yeah, and she is kind of... it's almost like there's something inside of her. I mean, she kind of pictures it that way. Like this piece of sea snake that she swallowed wrong in the beginning of the story. And so she refers to it as the Kreen.
The Kreen.
And it's sitting there in her chest for decades. And sometimes it can, like, sometimes it uses her eyes and makes her give people a scary look. So I guess she has crazy eyes, whether or not there's a Kreen or not. There's something about her that...
it's kind of unsettling, I guess.
Unsettles some people, yeah.
Yeah. And settles her, too.
Yeah.
Because one of the reasons I think she fixates on Yemaya so much is that being with her makes the Kreen kind of fade into the background.
Right.
So she doesn't have this kind of scary, controlling thing in her chest that's making her into a... scary person. Whatever that's about.
Yeah.
Not quite sure. But yeah, she always seems to kind of stay in a state of childlike views and emotions, even as an adult. She's kind of like halted in that.
Everything's very straightforward for her, I think, is part of that. I mean, even when it's wrapped up in, like, her weird form of spirituality involving Yemaya. Like, it's more a more direct like, cause and effect, a more direct response to things than a lot of adults have. Which is, I think a hallmark of how we define childlike behavior in some ways. Like, some combination of that and fantasy, but I'm thinking of, like, when you're, you know, like, you're walking through the store and you see someone who is, like, only has one arm, and no one says anything about it, and then some kid's like, hey, why do you only have one arm?
Yeah.
And the parents are embarrassed, but the kid's, like, not trying to be a jerk. They see a thing and they want to know about it, and so they ask about it. And there's not, like, that extra layer of, is this appropriate?
Yeah. Yeah. She also just doesn't understand how some stuff works that she probably should, so.
Well, also that.
That's a part of it.
Also that.
Alright, so what about Yemaya? Like, I don't know, do you find her worthy of Mariama's religious-like attention?
I mean, I personally wouldn't worship her, but it sounds like she is a pretty young woman. Which is part of what Mariama likes. It's part of why she gets some attention from men as well.
Mm-hmm.
She is, I guess, she must be a decent teacher, scholarly type person. She has some interest in some cultural things. It's hard to say. I don't think it's purely academic interest. She seems to be going on one of those find herself type of journeys as well.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, particularly her interest in, like, the beauty contest or whatever it was in this remote village where we can go see this.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't feel so much as, like, oh, let's go see this cool cultural societal thing. It kind of felt like someone who's trying to be really cool by being like, listen to this thing I know about that we should go see because it'll make us cool. Yeah. And it honestly felt more like that to me than like an earnest endeavor.
I agree. It did seem almost more like the hipstery, oh, well, this is what the authentic version is like.
Yeah.
So we have to go see this one because the one in the big city just, you know, they've ruined it by making it too commercial.
Right. Basically.
Yeah.
And then she also just kind of has this air of, we know something's going on with her. She's clearly a little screwed up, which is a common theme for all of the characters in this book. But there's some stuff about her I don't think we ever quite figure out. Because Mariama was only 10 when they meet, there's stuff Yemaya never tells her. And Mariama kind of tries to logic it out and figure out what it is, but then, you know, we can't necessarily trust her conclusions because she was young at the time. So I think part of her just, like, kind of remains shrouded in a mystery. We don't really fully know who she is, I don't think.
Yeah, because she's, Mariama kind of talks her into being her mother / big sister, take mm-hmm. care of her, and then they get to the city and she disappears.
Yeah.
Almost immediately. Yemaya disappears almost immediately.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like she wasn't ready for it.
Yeah. Like, she thought she was, but then she wasn't actually.
Yeah. Like, weird weird sexual activities in a hotel room might have something to do with that.
I guess we could bring that up now.
Yeah, it seems worth mentioning. I imagine that a fair number of people who read the book walk away pondering what that scene was about.
Yeah, such a story. This is like, I think some people find this kind of slightly disturbing, so this is just a slightly weird sexual thing involving someone who's probably too young to be involved in that sort of thing. One of Mariama's whole things is that, you know, she worships Yemaya, and earlier in the book she says, like, they bring up sex, and I think, what do they call your vagina? Like, your golden intention or something?
Oh, your golden meaning?
Yeah, your golden meaning. And don't give it away until, like, you found, like, the right person or something. And Mary Alma, who's quite young at this point, is like, oh, I want to give mine to you. And Yamiya is like, no, that's not appropriate.
If it's not what I meant.
And so later, when they finally reach the city, Mary Alma does this thing again where, again, it's really weird because, like, it doesn't seem like she entirely knows what's going on here, but she basically does the same thing where they're in the hotel room and she says, you know, like, I want to give it up to you and blah, blah, blah. And then it seems that they do a little bit of something. And then Yamiya was like, all right, let's go out. And they do. And then Yamiya disappears.
Yeah.
And you're like, did an adult woman just inappropriately touch a little girl?
Did it?
What is happening?
Did a 20-year-old and a 10-year-old just have some form of sexual encounter? Well, the answer is yes.
Yes,
they did have some form of sexual encounter. And then Yamiya disappears, never to be seen again.
Yeah.
And who knows why.
Yeah, or why that happened.
Right.
I thought that part was kind of confusing, because most adults would just be like, no, we might need to have a more serious talk about this later, but yeah, this is, like, not a thing that's going to happen.
Put your pants back on.
But that was one of the parts I found kind of disturbing, because, like, Yamiya's sitting on the bed, like, looking very kind of disturbed or confused or fighting with herself or something. And
it's got to be at least partly an indicator that she didn't know what the hell she was doing either.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's pretty weird. And it kind of fits in with, I guess to skip ahead just a little bit, some of the moral issues of the books. Violence and sex and the two kind of being intertwined sometimes is, like, a big thing that happens time and again in the book. And this potentially is tied into that because, well, Mariama, like, wouldn't have seen it as, like, a violent anything, you know? It was still definitely inappropriate, and the narrative does not seem to be condoning it in any way, but
yeah,
it is a very confusing scene, and apparently, to people who read the book, to a fair number of people who read the book, it's a pretty disturbing scene, so.
Yeah. And, you know, I guess in the sex and violence idea, give us a chance to talk a little bit about a couple other characters, just briefly. So Mohini, who, as it turns out, Mina probably beat to death on her way out of the relationship.
Yeah, this is Mina's girlfriend, Mohini, that she, yeah.
Yeah.
Possibly beat to death.
Possibly. We don't have confirmation on that, but it seems pretty likely. Walked in on her having sex with a man, and then Mohini kind of tried to play it off, kind of as you would expect a little bit, maybe, I don't know. So Mohini's like this kind of poetic, spiritual character, which plays into her cultural role a little bit, I guess. So she's a trans woman, which has, like, a slightly different cultural niche than in the United States, for example. It sounds like it's almost kind of expected that if you, I can't remember off the top of my head what their word was for it, hijiribe or something along those lines.
Yeah.
Like, you're almost expected to have some sort of insight and, like, sing songs about, specifically at funerals, was it?
The birth of boys.
Birth of boys. I had that ass backwards. But the birth of boys. But then at the same time, having a reputation as prostitutes, probably because society won't let them do much else. And so Mohini has the more, like, spiritual, insightful part of that. Is a character who talks about those things, who's always, oh, you know, so this is your way and this is my way, and it fits into, like, the wider universe, man.
Yeah.
Kind of deal. And I wasn't entirely sure what to make of it. I think by the time she was, I guess you would call it cheating, since Mina wasn't expecting to see it happen. But, like, kind of trying to play it off, like, oh, this is just a whole energy thing. And it's like, no, this is you cheating, actually.
Yeah. And then she freaks out and beats her head against a dresser or something.
Which is also not a good thing to do.
Yeah, you probably should not do that when that happens to you. But, I mean, I guess there are a couple interesting things there with... So you have a trans character, you have woman-on-woman violence, and, like, a lot of, or Mina used to work at a women's center, so she saw a lot of women who came in who were being beaten, or abused by men.
Yes.
But this is, like, definitely a different take on that. What was the other thing I was going to say? I don't remember. I feel like I had something insightful to say, but now I'm not sure that I do. So never mind.
Rut-row.
I guess one of the things going on here that's, like, important why Mohini is the way she is that there's this conversation Mina has with her grandmother, where her grandmother's basically saying, like, well, don't you think she's going to cheat on you because... those types of people sleep around. And she's like, Grandma, that's because in the past they've been forced to be prostitutes, and that's not a thing. And it's, I guess, part of the impression you get from the book is that she's holding Mohini kind of to this, like, impossible standard, and then when she fails to live up to it and is doing this thing that is expected of these types of people, then Mina just, like, freaks out. Because she's like, oh... she's a person and she screwed up, so...
Yeah. Well, there's some disillusionment happening there. And also because Mohini seems to be kind of her spiritual guide, though to a lesser degree than Yemaya is for Miriyama.
Yes, definitely.
Because she keeps asking questions of her and referencing her in her narrative.
What Mohini would be advising me to do at this point, yes. Or what she'd be telling me, yeah. Definitely. Okay. So, I mean, as you can tell, the four main characters that we just discussed are all women, so just bringing that up really quickly for our, you know, token feminism point and moral issues.
That's right.
But the nice, I guess the nice thing about it, even though they're not nice people, is that they're not all just, like, great people. They're all super screwed up. But that's, you know...
right, they have complexity.
Yeah. And I did read one complaint about Mohini where someone said, well, it kind of sucks that, she, like, never really shows up in the book.
Mm-hmm.
Except for Mina's memories of her, and then, like, that one little scene at the end. Whereas we get a lot of, like, Yemaya talking for herself. So they're like, you know, as a trans woman, if you're claiming that, like, their voices are being taken away, that's, like, exactly what Mina's kind of doing to her by her, like, not being in the book as much. So I guess some people don't really dig that. So I thought I'd go ahead and bring that up. And then one thing I just wanted to mention is, so, like, because this is the near future, there's, like, a lot of little fun technology tidbits here and there that are pretty cool. And one that Mina kind of mentions offhand that I thought was really cool, is one of the reasons that she has a lot of sex and doesn't worry about it is because at this point in the future, they've discovered basically, like, a universal birth control. And when you hit puberty... they give it to you. I guess it's like a shot or something. She didn't really say. And then it's not until you decide, okay, I want to have kids, that you go back to the doctor and they remove it. So she can just go around and not have to worry about any of that sort of, well, at least pregnancy. I don't know about the STDs thing, but...
Sounded like that was less of a threat too, actually. Like, there's fancier drugs now.
And more of them were curable.
Yeah, and... the Monica Byrne did a what is certainly in more recent science fiction a very common trope and say, oh, let's take a thing and swap out nano for the new prefix, and that's how you know it's better. So the nanobiotics instead of antibiotics.
Yeah.
And I think it was even mentioned at some point that those could target a lot of viral infections, and so it left less to worry about.
Yeah. But that's kind of interesting, considering our modern-day struggle with birth control. So, yeah.
Yes.
Let's see. Oh, yeah, so some of the other cool stuff going on in this book. There's something called a mitter, which is like a little chip in your arm or something. And it basically holds, like, your whole bank account and whatever else on it. So when you pay for stuff, you just kind of, like, wave your arm in front of the scanner instead of like having to carry around cards or anything like that on you.
Yeah, which sure seems like a direction that we could be moving in.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any way to use a credit card directly from your smartphone without carrying the card yet? Sure seems like it's not that far away if you can't.
I know at some places, like I know at Starbucks, you can pull up a thing on your phone and just...
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's definitely, and it's one of those things I think in this book where it's like, yeah, this is super convenient, but at the same time, because it tracks you everywhere you go.
Right.
How much privacy or like, can you get away from those sorts of things?
Right. Well, it's not even that futuristic. It almost sounds like it's like an Apple Watch that you don't have to recharge every 23 minutes. with some fancy apps on it.
Yeah.
Mitter's probably just short for transmitter, come to think of it.
Yeah. Fair enough.
Or everyone in, at least on the Indian side, everyone seemed to have a little chip, a little subcutaneous chip. That was part of how you were kept track of, too. I don't know if it was related to the mitter technology or how that works, but... it sounded like, you know, you had some pretty interesting options. There was an app in there that would basically serve as a universal translator.
Mm-hmm. That was cool.
Yeah. It must have been sending some sort of feed to your optic nerve, because you could walk around and people, whatever social media type of stuff you're willing to put in public, you could just see, like, hovering around people, walking around. And I mean, these are things that don't sound crazy at all to me. It actually sounds like a more realistic version, like some of the more, I guess depending on who you are, like more intrusive sounding, maybe especially socially related technologies are things that I think people would actually be kind of into. Whereas even a good chunk of science fiction written after cell phones and even smartphones became a thing. Like, no one ever seems to be carrying a smartphone around their starship.
Uh-huh.
Like, oh, well, we've got all these cool things we can do. It's like, people can do all of those things now with a smartphone.
Yeah.
You don't need a fancy starship to do that. You just need it to get from this rock to the other one. So that was interesting, and then energy seemed to be a big part of the background of this universe, too, which is obviously something people are thinking about. This trail that Mina's walking down in the first place is actually just a giant, like, wave energy collector stretching across the Arabian Sea.
Mm-hmm. It's like a giant bridge, but also a form of energy, or it's like...
Sounds like it's kind of accidentally a bridge.
Yeah.
Because if it was a real bridge, it would be wide enough to drive a couple of vehicles down it, I would assume. But if you can figure out your balance, you can walk it, which is what Mina and a few other folks do. But it's a thing that's made possible even just because of some advances in material sciences. Again, things that are kind of like related to things we do know about, the idea of like super cooled, like superconductors that work at 2 degrees Kelvin, but 2 or 3 degrees Kelvin, very close to absolute zero. But if you get any warmer than that, they lose their really neat properties.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, it's a relatively stable form of metallic hydrogen, which I've never heard of outside of the context of being part of the core of Jupiter, where pressure exists that we can't really simulate. So yeah, kind of, it's kind of an, and those things are all there, but they're not like the thing that drives the plot, other than
yeah.
that if this bridge doesn't exist, then she'd have to find a different place to walk her trail.
Yeah. But it's kind of cool. Like, all that background stuff. I thought all of that background stuff, like, in addition to being interesting, helped the world feel pretty real
mm-hmm.
that
yeah.
she built. So I appreciated that.
And the political stuff, too.
Because
mm-hmm. the technology and the politics in this book, it's good world building is what it is, because they're there and there's enough of it that if you start saying it out loud, like I was just doing, you realize there's a fair amount of information in there, but it doesn't do the thing that, I wouldn't even say bad science fiction does. I'd say a lot of science fiction has an unfortunate tendency to just give you these big info dumps sometimes.
Yeah.
And the harder your science fiction, the more likely that is to happen.
And this book resists info dumps so hard.
It does, yeah.
Because sometimes you're just like, I don't know what's happening.
It's like the opposite of info
yeah.
dumps.
okay, so themes of the book, which we've already, I think, more or less discovered, talked about. I say discovered because one of our themes is, like, searching for yourself and discovering
right.
who you are. running away from something. There's, like we said, definitely a travel narrative built in. So there's kind of those themes you find in travel sorts of narratives. And I thought maybe one potential theme was the violence that lives within us, because both of the co-tagonists struggle with it. Mariama with her, you know, Kreen or whatever that is, that kind of makes her a little dangerous. And then Mina, who doesn't seem to have violent tendencies until you find at the end that she possibly beat her girlfriend to death. So,
yeah.
But then these are two people who've also witnessed a lot of violence and have, like, tried not to commit violence to others. So I think there might be something in there about that aspect of that darker side of people or something, I don't know.
The old man's inhumanity to man theme.
Yeah. and then unlike most books, we actually do have a couple symbols for this one that I did want to mention because I was excited about it. So the title itself is a symbol, The Girl in the Road. Both Mariama and Mina run across a literal girl in their road. In Mariama's case, it's some kind of refugee or some younger girl who just, like, died on the road that they're driving through. And in Mina's case, it may or may not be actually, that girl may or may not actually be there. We're not sure.
Right.
She's like, oh, it's this girl who died on the trail, but then later you start going, oh, maybe she didn't actually see a real girl there.
Right.
So.
Yeah, because several chapters later she says, oh, by the way, that girl had Mohini's face.
Yeah.
Just like it looked after I finished beating her maybe to death.
And you're like, Right. And then you have, of course, the two narrators who are both on the road. So they're literally girls in the road.
Yes.
And then you have a bunch of other stuff where Mina's running into this specter called Bloody Mary, who may or may not exist, and potentially running into Mariama, maybe, who may or may not exist on the bridge. This is the part of the book where I got very confused, and I am not willing to make any confident statements about what happens at this point in the plot, because I did not know what was going on.
Yeah, when Mina encounters Mariama, who is older.
Yes.
So their two stories are not happening in parallel, as you probably, as I thought for a good chunk of the book, at least.
Yeah.
And Mariama is her, like, actual mother, was that what I was supposed to believe?
Okay. Yes. Because we know that this woman that Mariama stabbed to death was pregnant, but then Mariama has this whole thing where she says she, like, also gives birth to the Kreen or something.
Yeah.
And then Mina mentions that they both have, like, the same type of mouth, and then you're like, wait, are you, like, actually Mariama's daughter? But Mariama, as far as we know, wasn't pregnant?
Are you figuratively one of her mothers?
What is happening?
Yeah.
Did you kill her? Did she die? Did... what? So... yeah. And then Mina finds people at the end, again, who have, like, the same mouth as hers, or, like, who look at her mouth and know who she is or something, and I'm like, what is happening
because
in this book?
In the intervening years between Mariama as a college student and murdering Mina's parents and as an old woman meeting her on the trail, did she have a family? Is that who that was? I don't know.
I have no idea. I didn't really get it, so if anyone wants to enlighten me, please feel free.
Indeed.
But the girl on the road, symbol. And the other big symbol throughout the whole book is snakes.
Yeah. They keep coming back.
Yeah, both Mina and Mariama actually mentioned that a snake caused them to run away at the beginning.
Yes.
Mina said, someone planted a snake in my bed. What's this? This might be terrorists. And Mariama says she returned to go find her mom, and then there was a big snake, so she ran away. And then you find out that neither one of them actually saw a literal snake. And that is a stand-in for something else. And then I thought the fact that Mariama, like, choked on the sea snake at the beginning, and then it, like, stayed lodged in her chest. There was that snake stuff going on. I don't know exactly why.
I cannot enlighten you, I fear.
But it was clearly there for a purpose, so I thought it was important to mention. So, yeah. Any of these points of interest moments that you want to, talk about?
Oh, I thought I'd at least touch on the Lotus Eaters, so to speak.
Yeah.
Speaking of travel narratives.
Yeah.
Those of you who are familiar with the Odyssey will remember the Lotus Eaters. In this case, the Lotus Eaters are people who will confiscate your desalinator, which is a problem when your source of water is the ocean, if you don't tell them a good story. Which I just thought was kind of interesting and weird in the middle of the story. And then, so Mina tells them a good story, and they say, okay, you can pass. And then she throws the desalinators into the whole ocean and tries to live on 500 milliliters of seawater a day.
Yeah, and then she, like, runs into a dude who owns a hot dog stand, and he feeds her hot dogs.
Until she gets better, and then she smashes his hot dog stand and thanks, I guess. Another strange episode.
This is the part of the book where I started going, what?
Well, and it's where the unreliable narrator, because you have this girl who's been walking for thousands of kilometers down this weird seaborne road, and for several days before encountering this person, like, trying to survive on salt water.
Yeah.
And being, like, visibly malnourished and sick by the time she gets to this thing.
Yeah. So, we don't really know what that's about. But yeah, it was kind of interesting. She ran into some Odyssey parallel human beings. Alrighty, so strengths and weaknesses of the writing itself.
Alright, so I guess we've kind of been saying that one of the downsides is that it's hard to tell exactly what happens.
Yes.
But I found that it was actually not a difficult book to read, even though I didn't know it was happening a lot.
Yeah, even though I was confused, I didn't have a hard time reading it. It wasn't super dense.
There's a lot of mystical types of things in there that, if written differently, I might have kind of rolled my eyes and skimmed past it. That I didn't really do. Maybe it's just because it was all coming from a different cultural type of context. And so maybe I found that a little bit interesting.
I thought that the, like, narrative itself was pretty compelling, even though, again, Dan, I didn't really know what was happening. And another thing is that even though it's a travel narrative, sometimes when I read travel stories, I get kind of bored, and this one never sank into any of those traditional tropes that bore me. So I personally appreciated that there was, like, always interesting stuff going on.
Yeah.
And then it wasn't just, like, a big stretch of pages talking about how they're traveling and that sort of thing.
Yeah, I guess the two traditional travel stories are the going from exotic locale to exotic locale or the being chased by something road story.
Mm-hmm.
And this was really neither of those. Well, Skyworks is like, I don't know, a lot of the ways I can think of to describe the book and the characters are ways that I would describe books and characters I'm not usually that interested in reading, but I actually didn't mind reading this book at all.
Yeah.
Because it's a more contemplative road story, maybe. It's like the things they're running into are less important. There are a couple of interesting episodes, you know, the beauty contest or the Lotus Eaters or the whatever, but the focus of the story isn't in getting you there and having an adventure and then getting to the next one and having an adventure, which would be, you know, the Odyssey style of mm-hmm. travel story. So yeah, there's that. And I guess since I was saying that, my verdict is that it was a pretty good book. I mean, I think it was worth reading. It was different than other things I've read, for sure.
Yeah, I also thought it was interesting, even though the ending, again, left me confused. And when I ended it, I was like, well, I kind of wish I would have understood what was happening better. Mm-hmm. That was the main part that annoyed me about it, I thought. But otherwise, it was pretty interesting, pretty compelling. And I just want to know, like, basically what the deuce was happening at the end of that book, and who are these people, and why is this significant? Because I just wasn't sure that I fully grasped what was going on there, and it kind of bothered me. So,
what you reading right now?
I am reading The Strange and Beautiful Sorrows of Ava Lavender by Leslie Walton. It's a Candlewick book I picked up while interning for them this summer. So it's YA, but like a older bent YA for sure. And it's pretty interesting, very quirky, so I'm trying to figure out if it's quite my brand of quirky or not.
And I'm reading Shadow Shaper by Daniel Jose Older. His name is spelled Older. It's probably not pronounced Older.
Spoiler alert.
Yeah.
Ben's reading Shadow Shaper.
That's right. Which is going to be a novel ideas episode at some point.
One of these days.
Maybe before this one. I don't know.
Yep.
It'd be funny if it turned out that way.
We're from the future.
So I guess if you have any comments or questions, or you know what the hell happened at the end of
yes,
Girl
please.
On the Road, then you can leave a comment on our website, novelideaspodcast.com.
You can text the podcast officially, or text, sorry.
Text the podcast to the following phone number.
Yeah, no, thank you.
Series of bleeps.
You can tweet us. You can either tweet novel ideas at novel ideas pod, or you can tweet me and I will respond at classic sum up.
Or if you're getting this through Minerva.
Yeah.
You could comment on the Minerva post as easily as on our own website. That's minervamag.com if you're getting this not through Minerva, because you should go there.
Yeah, you should check us out through Minerva and then check out other Minerva's stuff. Three other podcasts, so that's fun. And you can also find Minerva on Facebook and Twitter if you really want to interact with me via Minerva instead. That's fine.
That's fine. Be our guest. And we are still on iTunes.
Yep. We have a logo and everything. It's very exciting.
That's right. We look like we've spent more than 3 seconds thinking about this podcast.
Thank you, Rhea. Once again.
Yes. So I believe that's everything for Girl on the Road.
Yeah. And we can't say for sure what we're doing next week because we know what our next several books we're going to record are, but we don't know in what order we're going to release the podcasts.
Yeah, I have 4 or 5 options for the next one that I bother to edit into a complete state. I don't know which one it'll be, so we'll try to tell you before we post episodes, but I don't think we've done a fantastic job of that yet.
No, we're still calibrating to getting back on track.
Yeah. But I think that's going to do it. So we'll see you next time. Bye. Is fucking tough. There's no question that time. It is rougher stuff.